Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. More than a week has passed since Typhoon Haiyun ripped through the Philippines. While it's been difficult to get an accurate number of how many people died in this storm, many more will likely succumb to disease or dehydration as relief slowly pours into the hardest hit regions. Many Americans spring into action after hearing news of such disasters, emptying their cupboards of old canned goods, medicines, and clothing to be shipped off as aid. Jessica Alexander urges you not to. She's author of Chasing Chaos, My Decade in and Out of Humanitarian Aid. We read her article, Please Don't Send Your Old Shoes to the Philippines, on Slate.com. And we reached her earlier this week at the UN.
Well, Americans are extremely generous, and as I said in my piece, and as I say in my book too, that human instinct and human impulse is one that should be commended and encouraged. Why I wrote the article was more about how people can use that generosity and channel it in a way that will really make a difference. Some people tend to just send stuff that they assume that people need overseas, but when you're actually on the ground responding, it's really chaotic, and you're just, at this point now, trying to get in life-saving materials in a situation where, you know, the roads are totally blocked. There's a huge swath of area that's very difficult to reach. And so we really just need to be focusing right now on getting in life-saving water, food, and shelter as well. And so when people who, again, are very well-intentioned and well-meaning are sending old clothes or old items, it really just slows things down. It's hard for people to kind of get their head around why it's actually not good to be sending stuff instead of money, but I think it's a really important message.
Well, I'd like to get to that because you've noted that, you know, people well-intentioned go through their closets and pack food and detergent and canned goods. And what are some of the more bizarre things you've seen turn up in an aid box?
Well, I've seen everything from tampons when or in a very remote community where women don't use tampons. And what they did is they refashioned the applicators for candle holders. I've seen, you know, thermal tent heaters in tropical climates show up. I've seen pasta show up in places where people have never seen pasta and they don't know how to cook it, and so they end up eating it raw. I've seen English books show up in places where children don't know how to, you know, they've never seen English before. And so again, you know, just think through when you are donating, think through what's going to happen at the receiving end.
Yes, Jessica, I get it. You know, that maybe your old shoes and, you know, open tubes of Neosporin might not be useful to people, but you write that they're actually harmful. How can donated goods be harmful in a country after a disaster on the scale of the Haitian earthquake or now in the Philippines?
Well, as I said, it's important to keep in mind what's going on in the Philippines right now, that we're just trying to sort in getting life-saving goods right now. And when you send in boxes of things that are not useful, it slows down the response and thus can be harmful. But also, I mean, imagine if you're sending medicines that, you know, you think are needed, but people don't know how to read those labels. They don't know what to do with those items. They may just be sitting in a box because civil servants and aid workers are tending to getting the water and the food to people and appropriate medicines. They may expire. A child may pick them up. I mean, there's just so many potential consequences when it's not controlled and regulated. The real issue is that at this point, it just slows things down and it makes it much more difficult to actually get the life-saving stuff to the people who are in desperate need for it.
Is there a time later when those things could be useful?
You know, it's never a good time to give gifts in kind. There's a cost to shipping it. There's a cost to sorting it on the other end. There's a cost to transporting it, and there's a cost to warehousing it. Unwanted goods just kind of take up room and take up people's time that should be devoted to getting things that are needed. If people want to give gifts in kind, you should wait until an organization asks for specific items, because they're on the ground and they know what the exact needs are. They can identify what people are needing and what they can't procure locally.
So your recommendation is money, but that is a concern for a lot of people. I remember 3 years after the Haitian earthquake, all of the money that was pledged by Americans and other international aid organizations still hadn't been spent, even if giving to a reputable organization. How are people sure that their money is going to be spent in the right place?
If you're giving to a reputable organization, your money will be spent in the right place. And there are a lot of reports of money going unspent. I mean, people are, first of all, you have to understand that in a context like Haiti or in other places that are very poor, the capacity of these places to absorb millions and millions of dollars within 6 months, within a year, is very difficult. However, they're using the money to buy fuel so that we can go around and truck deliveries, much needed items, to remote places. We're using the money to also buy fuel to pay for generators, to keep the lights on so that we can work around the clock to identify where the needs are, to strategize about how we're going to reach them so that we can work on all cylinders to most effectively respond. I think people misunderstand that when they're giving money, that they think that they're giving to an individual person. They're giving to a humanitarian response. And a humanitarian response is very expensive to operate. I mean, you have to remember how logistically difficult it is to reach some of these places. That's going to require helicopters. That's going to require expertise and manpower to actually get there. And that's where your donation also goes. And so, you know, people might think, oh, when I deliver a teddy bear, that entire teddy bear is going to a child, versus if I give $10, well, maybe $5 will be spent on the actual food given to a family. But the other five, you know, the rest of it is spent on all of the mechanisms that are necessary to deliver that aid. It's a vital part of how the humanitarian operation runs.
Jessica Alexander, author of Chasing Chaos, My Decade in and Out of Humanitarian Aid, and the recent article, Please Don't Send Your Old Shoes to the Philippines. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks.
Two decades have passed since Swedish quartet Ace of Base picked up the mantle of ABBA. Ace of Base's single, The Sign, topped U.S. charts and cemented a place in pop radio playlists for generations to come. Ace of Base ushered in the Swedish music miracle, an era between 1990 and 2003 when music royalties earned by Sweden from foreign markets were twice as much per capita as royalties paid to songwriters and performers in the U.S. Today, Sweden is the world's number three music exporter. Nolan Feeney writes and produces for the Atlantic's Entertainment Channel, where he asked, why is Sweden so good at pop music? Nolan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Really? Highest royalties paid for 13 years? Were all of those grunge rockers and hip-hop stars of the 90s really Swedes in disguise?
Well, as I've learned from looking at the charts, that even when Sweden isn't participating in its own music miracle, that the producers and songwriters are very well represented behind the scenes in pop music in America, too.
Oh, so it's the people who are writing the songs and producing them.
Well, it's a little bit of both. Sweden's musical exports started to decline around 2003, but I don't think its reputation has really suffered, because in May of 2012, half of the top 10 songs on the U.S. Billboard charts had ties to Swedish producers and songwriters. And even then, you had a sort of second wave of artists like Licky Lee and Robin and The Knife that were more on the indie side, but continued to foster Sweden's reputation for being really great at pop music.
Let's hear a little bit from one of the artists you mentioned there. Here's Robin with the song Call Your Girlfriend. It's off her 2010 album Body Talk. Well, let's go back to the Swedish band that so many people know, ABBA, one of the most successful and most lucrative acts in the history of music. How did ABBA help shape Swedish pop music exports and the legacy we're living with today?
So according to this one research paper by Ola Johansson, ABBA was basically the role models that Sweden's pop music kind of needed. That, you know, in the 70s, there were Swedish athletes like Björk Borg and Ingemar Stenmark who sort of inspired a wave of Swedish people to take up, you know, tennis and skiing. And he proposed, you know, why couldn't the same happen in pop music? And there's evidence that suggests ABBA as a sort of industry force really helped kickstart Sweden's music industry and develop the institutional support and the personnel to make pop music a force to be reckoned with. And there's also their sound and their production style was very sort of internationally friendly and differed a little bit in the production trends of pop music at the time that made them sort of well received among a wide audience that was very influential in the decades after. Anybody could be that.
ABBA there with the 1976 mega hit, and one of my favorites, Dancing Queen. Let's fast forward to the 90s and early 2000s when Sweden was collecting millions in royalties. So what was going on in the country that nurtured this pop music juggernaut?
Well, in the late 80s, MTV came to Europe, and the channel was so popular among Sweden that the programmers started playing more and more as Swedish artists and really helped bring Swedish musicians to a more international audience and really help break down some doors. The study points out that ABBA initially had trouble finding an audience abroad, and even though, you know, they ultimately were very successful, that in their early stages, it was kind of hard to crack the British market and even the U.S. market for a little bit. And as Sweden became more and more represented on something like MTV, the barriers for international success started to fall down a bit. And now, you know, the idea of a pop act from Sweden is a major selling point.
What was the magic formula musically that seemed to work so well for these pop pieces like Ace of Base and others?
Well, it's hard to identify an exact formula. I think one of the things that is commonly attributed to Sweden's success is the fact that they're all very good English speakers. About 90% of Sweden speaks English, which is one of the highest percentages among European countries. And part of that is because of linguistic similarities to Swedish, and part of that is just Sweden's sort of cosmopolitan open culture. And the idea is that the better at English you are, the more your song lyrics will resonate.
Once again this happening.
Swedish indie songstress Leaky Lee there with the song Unrequited Love. That's from her 2010 album Wounded Rhymes. Now, Nolan, the Swedish government is famously hands-on, especially compared to the U.S. Does the government play any role in helping to create policy for artists, nurturing artists, or other incentives for musical acts?
Definitely. So one study found that a third of Sweden's school children have attended public music education programs. And one famous alumnus is Max Martin, a producer who's worked with Britney Spears and Taylor Swift and Katy Perry. So if you've rocked out to any of their hits, you can absolutely thank the Swedish government. Sweden's National Arts Council also has provided sort of millions of dollars annually in grant money to artists, and which really helps Swedish musicians tour and record new material. And pop and rock music don't get all of that grant funding, but it's still a very significant program that's helped a lot of artists.
Where's Swedish music now after this decade and a half nearly of the Swedish music miracle? Will it see another peak in exports over the coming years?
I don't know if it will see another peak. I think Sweden's reputation for having great pop music is alive and just as strong as it once was. I think in September, we saw an album from Iconopop, whose song I Love It has been all over the place, and they're two Swedish artists, and their album is great. it wasn't just a few years ago that Robin's Call Your Girlfriend and Dancing on My Own, sort of, she played on SNL. Her video was really parodied. I think there are a lot of musicians who are really holding the banner for Sweden, and I don't think that's going away. I got this feeling.
Well, Nolan, thanks for filling us in.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Nolan Feeney writes and produces for the Atlantic's Entertainment Channel. You'll find a link to read his article from The Atlantic called Why is Sweden So Good at Pop Music? It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we're going to leave you with the band Iconopop and the song I Love It. The song peaked at number 7 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart just this year and has sold more than 2 million copies here in the U.S. Stay with us for more Word of Mouth right after the break here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth for New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Doug Harlow was not afraid to use his voice. Before he was a reporter in Maine, he was a street poet in Boston and protested the Vietnam War in Washington, D.C. There was a time Doug could say, I love you, in a dozen languages. He's a born communicator, but that's not because he has the loudest voice in the room. Producer Emily Kwong reports.
It was the 17th of June, 2005, when 56-year-old Doug Harlow stepped up to the microphone.
You know, this really sucks. Not having a voice, but it's a message to everybody who can hear this voice now. Don't smoke.
Earlier that year, doctors had found cancer on Doug's vocal cords. In order to stay alive, he would have to lose his voice. So while a friend monitored the recording, Doug said some things to his family that he'd never be able to say again.
I love you, Mary Lou. Love you. Love you guys. Love you, Johnny. Love you, Georgia. Love you, Mary Lou. I love you, Mary Lou. Here, Sadie. Come on, Sadie.
It's been 8 years. There's a new dog.
Ugly. Can you sit? Good boy, would you like to be in a radio documentary?
And the throat cancer is gone.
A simple yes or no will do.
Doug came home from the hospital without vocal cords. That's because surgeons had removed his entire larynx, which is the organ of sound production. They cut a small hole at the base of his throat to allow him to breathe. And to speak, doctors handed him something called an electrolarynx. It was black, palm-sized, and battery-powered.
I remember it being like a foreign appendage, something that was a machine that I was supposed to be able to talk with, through. I didn't give myself any choice. You're gonna learn how to use it, and then you're gonna go back to work, and that was it.
Doug is 5'11", with brown eyes. His gaze is direct. Number 13 is tattooed on his left hand, which he applied himself with pencil lead and cigarette ash. This is the hand he speaks with.
There's another normal buttons for pitch, up and down, so I could speak in a lower voice. I speak in a higher voice. It's not easy to use. It's exhausting.
Doug wears his electrolarynx around his neck on a black cord. He'll hold it flush against his throat, and with the push of a button, the voice box vibrates. Kind of like his vocal cords used to.
Ladies and gentlemen, start your engines.
It's not an unpleasant sound, but you'd never mistake it for a human voice. One of the first times Doug was out in public, he went to a Mr. Paperback bookstore. He approached a female clerk whose back was turned and...
I approached her, saying, can you help me? She turned around, screamed, and ran into a back room. Slam the door shut. These are great. I've got a lifetime of this.
Doug rebounded quickly. He returned to work at the Morning Sentinel 5 weeks after his surgery. His colleagues wondered if he'd keep reporting or take a silent post behind the copy desk. When Doug made interview calls, sources hung up on him. They accused him of making a prank phone call. Colin Hickey sat directly across from him.
And this would just drive Doug crazy. Because, you know, he couldn't do his job. He couldn't get the information. And there were points where he'd ask me, can you make the call? Hey, my colleague has a mechanical voice. You've been hanging up on him. So when he calls next, just hold on and you'll get used to it.
Doug kept calling. And eventually, he stopped asking Colin for help.
Eventually, and I don't know if it was weeks, I don't know if it was months, but eventually, this artificial voice started to sound like Doug again.
I finally learned how to use this thing and how to, throw in an inflection.
These days, Doug is one of the paper's busiest reporters. He interviews cops and criminals and listens to the police scanner for activity. When he calls for information, the detectives understand his questions.
Sheriff's Department, Dispatch Marvel.
Good afternoon, Doug Arlo calling. Hey.
How's you anyway?
What, you recognize my voice?
Yes, sir. What do you need today? We haven't had anything much going on.
Yeah, well, that's my question.
I already anticipated it.
Well, I...
Hey, Daddy.
All right, well, that's good news. Thank you.
Doug is navigating life just fine with a voice box. He can say anything he wants to, but that doesn't mean he's always heard. It's changed the way he relates to people. Even his wife of 27 years, Mary Lou.
I'm still talking the way that I always spoke when he had a voice, too. So it is something that I have to try to keep in mind, even like during an argument, giving him the opportunity to argue back, because I can get louder than what he can. So that kind of stuff is real. It is what it is. Not that I ever intend to do it, but I do it.
What do you do when you're not being heard?
I shut up. And that's not like me. You know, I used to be outspoken a lot more than I am now because I cannot be heard. And if I can be heard, then I'm not gonna say it. It's frustrating at times. It makes me angry at times still.
Parties or loud restaurants can get discouraging. There's a lot Doug wants to say, but he ultimately depends on technology to say it.
It's the only thing I have, it's the only way that I can speak. And that's kind of weird if you slow down for a minute and think about that. You know, when the power goes out finally and fully, when the mountain meets the sea at Armageddon, I'm not gonna have batteries. And then I will be silent.
But Doug is far from silent. He's still heard because he's still here.
I knew I would survive. Because the last thing I want to do is die. My kids wouldn't have had a father. My wife wouldn't have had a husband. So I chose life. And this is what it sounds like.
And that piece came to us from producer Emily Kwong. While death scenes are plentiful in movies and on television, witnessing the real, degenerative, disorienting process of death and dying is avoided, unmentionable, a taboo. A new Showtime series faces that taboo head on. Time of Death follows 8 terminally ill people, ranging in age from 19 to 77, over the course of 9 months to their final hours and even moments of life.
Why are you participating in the documentary?
Well, I think it's like the big elephant in the room that nobody ever wants to talk about.
We're all going to die someday, but what's it going to look like at the end? What's going on? What am I going to do with the kids? What do their lives look like without me? I hope in some way that it might help somebody else facing the same horrific, horrible, life-altering dilemma. Life-ending dilemma?
That is Maria, a single mother of three with stage 4 breast cancer. She died on April 17th. Reviews and conversations cropping up around the series praise its raw, sometimes agonizing realism and wonder if anybody will want to watch, if our death-denying culture can take such an unflinching look at death. The Huffington Post religion reporter Javed Kalim wrote about the series. He covers one of HuffPost's most unique beats, and that's death. Hello again, Javed.
Hi.
Also joining us is Miggy Hood. She's co-executive producer for the Showtime series Time of Death. And Miggy, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, very, very nice to be here.
Well, what a series. It's very powerful. And you yourself have trained as an architect. I'm curious how you go from designing Hollywood sets to producing a show about death and dying.
Well, I've just lived in L.A. for 30 years. But this subject came up after I had experienced my mother's dying. What happened was she was living in England. I was living here, and I have two brothers and a sister who were living in England who didn't have any contact with her at all. She was quite isolated and taken care of only by me living far away. And she eventually went into the hospital, and I went over there and realized that she was nearing death. And so I contacted them and told them about it. And they hadn't seen her for about, I think one of them, my brother, 25 years, my sister, about 18 years, and my other brother, about 7 or 8 years. So they didn't actually believe that she was going to die. They eventually did come into the hospital right at the moment where she had had a massive seizure. And I thought passed away. And shortly thereafter, she kind of came back to life again. And they had this sort of extraordinary reunion. They connected. My mother sang songs. They told stories. And for a day or so before she went into coma, they had that moment. And it was very moving for everybody, particularly for my brother, who hadn't seen her for 25 years, who then sat by her bed for 2 weeks. And it just got me thinking, why do people do that? Why do people ignore people in life and then show up when it's nearly over? I felt that it was worth exploring. I think that we have a kind of contract with our fellow humans, and particularly our family, and we need to pay attention to.
Well, death, of course, touches everybody. Yet a lot of people, as I'm hearing from you, do not want to talk about it, avoid it. I'm wondering how you found the families to film for the program. Was it a challenge to find people who were willing to let their last hours and their family's experience of that be filmed?
Yes, it was a challenge to find them. But once we found the ones who wanted to, I mean, it was very clear that they were interested in being a part of this. I mean, I can tell you how we went about it. We went to hospice organizations, cancer centers, word of mouth. I mean, I found Lenore's family through brother-in-law of a friend of mine who's a palliative care doctor. And in fact, when I called him up to broach the subject, and oftentimes, of course, people, you know, were wary of it and felt that it would be just something that was sort of distasteful. But this particular doctor said to me that only the other day in a meeting he said how much they needed mass media, and we needed to talk about palliative care.
Lenore, with her absolutely wonderfully loving husband, Mel, just one of those characters that we meet there. But I am curious to hear from both of you. Let's start with you, Javed. How you think the camera changes the experience for the dying and for their survivors?
Well, you know, when I was speaking to Miggy about this, one thing I learned is that, you know, in the process of being in the background of filming these different people and their families, the camera actually keeps them going in a way. I used to work at the Miami Herald as a reporter, and one thing I did was I'd write obits. And I'd always think that, you know, people wouldn't want to talk to me in such a ton of pain when somebody they loved had died. But actually people, those who are dying and those whose loved ones die, really want to keep their stories alive and be remembered and be cared about. And so I had a sense from watching the show, from the series, as well as just my interviews, that there was a lot of tender appreciation on both sides of the camera.
Miggy, what do you mean by that, the camera kept people going?
Well, I mean, on a very basic level, I think it you know, gave them something to look forward to, gave them something to think about other than the inevitable. Thinking about how you want people to go on afterwards, you know, in Maria's case, what she wants to happen to her children, or in Lenore's case, how she wants the very end to sort of to be for everybody. Those are things that, you know, I mean, I think in life we need to have an activity, you know, to keep us going. I think we all sat around thinking about how we're going to die. We, you know, be a bit depressing. but on the other hand, it does deserve consideration because it's something you're doing for the people in your life as well, the people who surround you. I mean, nobody wants to be a burden in life, and they certainly don't want to be a burden in death.
Miggy Hood is co-executive producer for Showtime's new series, Time of Death. It's a documentary-style reality TV program that dares to put terminal illness in the spotlight. Also with us is Javed Khalin. He's national religion reporter for The Huffington Post, and he wrote about the series. Javed, this is what brings in our cultural conversation. When did talk about the end of life become so taboo in our society? I mean, public mourning used to be commonplace. Can the return to frank discussions about death be attributed to any particular event?
There's no one thing. And, you know, everyone's different, and some religions or cultural groups are still very, very in tune with the dying and dying process, whether because that's something intrinsic about who they are or because they experience lots of death in their lives. People used to bury their own loved ones when they died, have home viewings. And now you have, since the Civil War afterwards, you now have the funeral director come over, or you have somebody die in a hospital, you know, with doctors around them. So, you know, death has been, in a literal way, been taken, put aside in a sense. Unless it's your parents or somebody you love that's close to you that you see die in your home or you experience their last years or days, most of us don't see it all the time. And so this show is, you know, putting on a very big network that process. And on the show, you actually, you know, you don't just see people in their last days. In the series, the documentary series, you see people actually die. You see their last seconds, their last breath. Which is, that's a very powerful moment. And it is a taboo one to put on the TV screen. It is risky. This would not happen on a, on, you know, a NBC or CBS, these huge networks. But it can happen on still a big network like Showtime, which can be a little more risky in what it does.
Now, Javed, this is a pretty unflinching look at life. Even the title, Time of Death. Is there something larger going on inside of our society that's saying it is time to talk about death?
I think there is. I mean, you know, when I began to focus in part on writing about death for Huffington Post, I thought, what am I going to actually find to write about? But then I realized, oh my gosh, there's so much happening. And by that I mean there's people, you know, who are talking and thinking about death and dying across the country and the world in very intentional ways. One example that is happening, you can find in any city in the U.S. and any small big city, is called death cafes. When you first hear that word, you think it's kind of like morbid, or it's some, you know, Halloween party or event. But it's these people in different cities get together informally, formally, serve some tea and cake. And maybe it's led by a hospice chaplain, maybe it's led by just somebody who's grieving or has experienced death. And they talk about death, anything goes. Whatever you want to talk about, ask about, share about dying. And these happen in Starbucks, or they happen in, you know, they happen in coffee shops and restaurants and people's homes. And so there is a cultural moment here. You know, it's not just what's on TV, but it's what people in the community are doing. We're also, you know, becoming much more, you know, open in terms of health care and our political discussions talking about the growing population of baby boomers and retirees and their needs at the end of life. So there's these different elements coming together.
What about, Miggy, the inescapable truth here, that the people who are in this series are going to die?
They're all going to die. That's the thing.
Well, that's the thing. But, you know, you and your camera crew are there watching somebody die. And I'm just wondering about, A, the effect on them, and also this realization of, like, oh, my God, this person's going to die. Do we need to get them on film? I mean, there must be some questions that come up for you as a filmmaker about those kinds of things.
Well, I think that obviously there was a huge amount of sensitivity necessary, and indeed everybody was incredibly sensitive, and it was. I mean, I've heard nothing but how this was the most profound and moving experience that the people who worked on this show have ever had. Certainly, on a professional level, and I think on a personal level, we had we also had a hospice worker, a therapist, who came into the office. Was available to talk to people who, you know, who found it difficult. And there was an enormous amount of sensitivity necessary, but there's an enormous amount of sensitivity necessary in everything we do. And people should pay attention to everything, whether it's, you know, somebody's life is ending or somebody's life is beginning. I mean, I recently saw a documentary that a friend of mine made, a brilliant documentary about midwifery and giving birth, and I had never seen anything like that before, and I think that this is the same. It's these are moments that we find distasteful, right?
Mm-hmm.
Giving birth, dying, distasteful. Nobody wants to talk about it. I don't know, Joey, if you have experienced in your investigations of this subject matter people believing that it's sacred in some way and shouldn't be talked about.
I think maybe those who have not experienced a death. Sometimes believe that, and it is, you know, it is a sacred experience, but that's not all it is. There is, you know, much more to it, and people are very, I wouldn't say happy to relive the moment, but, you know, but appreciative of the experience and what it is, accepting it for what it is, which is a death.
Which, if I can just jump in and say, is a very interesting response, because it's not about entertainment. This is not about, you know, giving someone a feel-good experience or a feel-bad experience. It's just about truth.
Miggy Hood, co-executive producer for Showtime's new series, Time of Death. And Miggy, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Javed Kalim, national religion reporter for The Huffington Post. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
You'll find a link to Javed's article on Time of Death, as well as a link to watch the pilot episode of the show. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. The assassination of President John F. Kennedy 50 years ago this month left a country in shock, disbelief, and as time marched on, awash in conspiracy theories. Nearly 1,000 books have disputed the central finding of the Warren Commission that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone when he shot the president. Today, almost two-thirds of the American public believe that Oswald and his assassin, Jack Ruby, were part of a larger conspiracy. Richard Mosk was a 23-year-old attorney when he became the youngest member of the commission established by President Johnson to investigate the murder of JFK. He's now Associate Justice on the California Court of Appeals. In an article for Stanford Magazine, Mosk wrote that he is apprehensive about the upcoming anniversary, which will again stir up the conspiracy theories that have shadowed the Warren Commission's conclusions for half a century. Justice Mosk, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Generally speaking, what was your role in the investigation?
My role was basically to do research and investigation on any topic that any of the counsel on the staff asked me to do.
And I understand that you paid particular attention to Oswald's marksmanship ability.
Well, I found that, of course, he was an experienced marksman. He'd been in the Marine Corps, and he'd been a hunter, and he had practiced with the ultimate assassination weapon prior to the assassination. I also worked on his finances and was able to determine that his income pretty much matched his expenses, which would suggest that he was receiving no compensation from anybody other than that which he received from his work.
26 volumes of evidence, 50,000 pages of numbered documents in the Warren Commission's report. Yet still, conspiracy theories surrounding Kennedy's assassinations have been so pervasive. Why do you think, Justice Musk?
Well, there are the obvious reasons that the cause has to match the effect in many people's minds. This was the idea that an insignificant misfit could bring down the leader of the free world is hard to imagine. And a number of books were written for profit. Publishers certainly stood to profit from these books. I don't know. It's very hard to imagine. It's sort of like flying saucers or other phenomena that people grasp hold of.
Well, of course, there are many people who would differ with your opinion. I'd like to play a clip. This is from a recent NPR interview with Fresh Air's Dave Davies and the author Philip Sheenan. He's a former investigative reporter for The New York Times. His new book is called A Cruel and Shocking Act, The Secret History of the Kennedy Assassination. Here's Sheenan. He's talking about Justice Warren's decision not to share the autopsy photos from the investigation with the rest of the commission.
Chief Justice Warren actually looks them over. And after he looks them over and sees how horrifying they are, he makes the decision that nobody else will be allowed to see them. That includes the other commissioners and all of the members of the commission staff. And this creates a huge division on the commission. The young staff members, and again, Arlen Specter in particular, protest repeatedly, saying they have to have the autopsy photos because they are the essential medical evidence that will allow them to determine how the president died and who might have killed him. And to the very last stages of the investigation, the staff fights for those photos, and ultimately they are refused. And those photos would remain under seal in the custody, apparently, of Robert Kennedy for years thereafter.
Author Philip Sheenan there, recently interviewed on Fresh Air. Do you remember, Justice Musk, being points of contention between members of the commission or disagreements about methodology, access, or omissions in the reporting?
There were instances where some members of the staff would disagree with senior members or the commissioners on certain things. But in the end, none of the material that allegedly was withheld from the commission or its staff really made any difference. For example, on the autopsy photos, yes, it should have been made available. I would agree with Mr. Sheenan on that. On the other hand, there was sufficient testimony from the autopsy physicians, and later access to those photos was given to, I think, up to 20 autopsy physicians, and they all confirmed the results of the Warren Commission report. So in the end, there were differences over methodology, maybe some errors in methodology, but there was no significant consequence, no consequence on the result at all.
How about the sharing of information between the CIA and the FBI? There are a number of people who have come out and said that, well, we wanted to confirm what J. Edgar Hoover, the imperious head of the FBI at the time's belief was, that Oswald acted alone. Did you experience any sort of sharing of information between the FBI and the CIA when you were working on the Warren Commission report?
Well, I don't know what the FBI shared with the CIA or vice versa. The allegations, for example, Mr. Sheenan's book, was that the FBI withheld information from the commission and the CIA held information from the commission. It was said, for example, that the FBI failed to disclose its awareness of Oswald prior to the assassination. That may be. That has no bearing whatsoever on whether Oswald was the assassin or whether there was any conspiracy. All it shows is that the FBI perhaps should have been more alert or attentive and may have theoretically prevented the assassination, but it doesn't have any bearing on the Warren Commission investigation. As to the CIA, allegedly withheld information about the then administration's activities vis-a-vis Cuba. Again, it would have been preferable had the commission had that information, but even if it had it, there was nothing further that it could have done. I mean, the commission did everything possible to discover any implication of Castro or Cuba in the assassination, and it came up with nothing. And so had it known that Castro or Cuba had a greater incentive, it wouldn't have made any difference in the result. That's the thing that people fail to understand, or these books fail to say, which is there may have been deficiencies, but the deficiencies have to have a consequence in the ultimate determination, and they didn't.
Well, you do write that the promotion of false conspiracy theories is not harmless. But scrutiny itself, of course, isn't a bad thing. So how do you suggest people find this balance between healthy skepticism and conspiracy theories about the assassination?
Well, it's, you know, you can't expect the people to go out and read everything there is. And I guess skepticism is fine. On the other hand, we have, throughout our history, had what one historian said, a paranoid philosophy of politics. People have always had skepticism. I just bought a book on the Lincoln assassination, where all kinds of theories have continued to emanate on the conspiracy to kill Lincoln. Various public figures were implicated and so forth. With respect to the sole assassin of President Garfield, for some time thereafter, people suspected some kind of a conspiracy. And the same is true of the assassination of McKinley. So this is not a new phenomenon. People are generally skeptical. On the other hand, when we intentionally falsify history, that's what I find to be disturbing. One can interpret history, but facts are something else.
What then should historians, the media, and the public focus on when they look back at the work of the Warren Commission on this anniversary?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with looking back on the report, criticizing it where it deserves criticism. All I can say is one has to bear in mind that the commission was put together quickly. It operated quickly. It put out a report in 6 or 7 months. And it did the very best it could, and the results have not been really found to be lacking by any serious person, I don't think. For example, in 50 years, if there was a conspiracy, it's pretty unlikely that it would have remained quiet and undetermined and unascertained for this period of time. Things don't happen like that. If there's a conspiracy, there are multiple people involved, and somebody has to have come forward or reported on it or admitted it, and it just hasn't happened. And there's been many investigations since that time, not only by the House Assassination Committee, which, by the way, supported all of the findings with the exception of one. They concluded that there was some acoustics evidence which suggested there was another bullet fired, which would suggest that there was another shooter. Shortly thereafter, the National Academy of Sciences said that acoustics evidence was wrong. You've had all these, and you've had the Department of Justice has conducted a further investigation. Nothing has turned up.
Richard Mosk, an associate justice on the California Court of Appeals and former staff member on the Warren Commission, thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Now, you can link to read his article for Stanford Magazine. It is called Truth Was Our Only Client. That link is at wordofmouthradio.org.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again for more Word of Mouth next week from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Bill Berry,
and Zach Nugent.
Our intern is
James Pouliot.
Digital support from Rebecca Lavoie
and Sarah Plord.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth
is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.